Now it gives me great pleasure to introduce tonight's speaker, Brian Vermorket.
Ryan, alcoholic.
Hi, Ryan.
It's a pleasure and an honor to be here. This is my second time speaking, and I'm really looking forward to it. As they just said, I'm from Orchid. I have a home group, goes to any length group. I have a sponsor, and you know, it's been going pretty good. My sobriety date is July 14th, 2024. Means I'm going to be 13 months sober on the 14th, so I'm pretty happy about that. I grew up in Orchid. Parts of my story are going to be a little different, but I think everyone will find a lot of the similarities there as well. You know, growing up, I had a really good childhood. You know, I had two parents that loved me, that provided for me. You know, I always had food on the table. You know, I was raised with morals. I was raised pretty dang good. But some stuff happened, and I never figured out any way to deal with it. One of the big things that happened to me that I remember is in the third grade, I say third grade, could have been second, could have been third, could have been fourth, but I remember third grade, I've always had a speech impediment, always sounded different, always had trouble pronouncing my R's, and I'm waiting in the lunch line, and one of the other girls in class says, "Ryan, why do you sound different?" And that just hit me, you know, and I just didn't want to talk anymore. I was like, I don't know why. It wasn't a big thing that was said, but it messed me up. You know, that kind of stopped me from wanting to talk. And one other thing that happened in school is I had volunteered to bring a shoebox for a class project, and I forgot. And looking back, I'm not even sure how true this story is, but this is how I remember it, is that I remember the teacher saying to someone else that she wasn't surprised that I forgot the school box, the shoebox, that she had expected that from me, is how I heard it. I don't know if that's true or not, but those two things kind of happened, so I was like, oh, I guess I shouldn't talk, and I guess people expect me to mess up. And I didn't know how to deal with that. Around that time, I kind of found my first escape, and that was reading. I loved reading because I could get away from all of life's problems that I couldn't deal with, and I could just read and be happy. You know, I could forget that I had not done this or not done that or disappointed someone. I could just go and open a book and read. And that worked. It felt really good. At least I thought it was working. Looking back, I was very angry because I didn't know how to deal with any problems at that age. I didn't know how to talk to anyone. I was so angry. And looking back, I think it was mainly fear. I was just so scared of being open to anyone because I had felt like I was a disappointment. I was already unworthy. And that's in third, fourth, fifth grade that I'm having all these feelings. I remember in high school, I started playing tennis. And over 3 years that I played tennis, I actually only broke rackets my first 2 years, but I probably broke 10 or 12 tennis rackets out on the tennis court because I was just so angry and did not know how to deal with it. The only thing I knew how to do is if I was disappointed, I got angry. If I was happy, I didn't know how to be happy, so I'd get angry. It was just, angry was my go-to. And around this time, I had drank a few times, but I hadn't gotten drunk. I don't remember my first drink, but I remember my first drunk. I was at a house party, and it was awesome. I loved it. I got hammered, completely blacked out, woke up in the morning, had a bunch of stuff drawn all over me, and thought, I want to do this again. This is great. You know? I didn't do it a lot throughout high school, but, you know, and looking back, I didn't realize that also coincided around with the time that I started playing tennis my senior year, and I didn't break any rackets. And I wonder if, you know, the alcohol was already an escape for me. It already helped me deal with some of that anger of being able to go out and drink, and just, I didn't have to feel as much. Even though I wasn't a daily drinker, I didn't even drink every weekend. Every other weekend, maybe. But it was always blackout. It was always as hard as I could go. I was going to drink until I passed out. And I did that for about 2 years, and then I decided, oh, I want to move up to San Luis. So I moved up to San Luis Obispo, and I'm like, I'm going to go to college. Everything's going to be great. And I started drinking a lot very quickly. You know, when I first came into this program, I would have said, you know, I didn't have the insanity until the last few years of my drinking. Looking back, no, it was almost instantaneous for me. I remember I moved up to San Luis in August, and that November I got a minor in possession. I was 20 at the time, and I was so heartbroken that I got a minor in possession for alcohol. I thought my life was over. I was like, this is terrible. This doesn't happen in my family. I was so heartbroken. I remember I ended up going home and just bawling to one of my friends. How did I let this happen? My life is over. I got to give up drinking, all this stuff. I think I maybe didn't drink the next night, you know, and then I was drinking immediately again, you know. And then, you know, very quickly, daily drinker and doing a lot of stuff that, looking back, I knew was wrong, but because I wanted to chase that feeling, I chased it. I remember this is maybe, I wasn't 21 yet, so this was within a year of me moving up to San Luis. One of my friends says, hey, let's do a road trip out to my house, his parents' house in Kernville. And I was like, cool. Like, oh, do you want to drive? I said, sure. And they said, oh, can we take some beers while we're driving? And I said, sure. Oh, can we also take the bong? Sure, why not? I don't care. You know, in my head, that's okay. It's none of us are 21 in the car. We're all sipping on beers, all smoking weed the whole ride over there. And looking back, I have no idea how I thought that was okay. But in my head, I didn't think it was a big deal. I thought it was normal. I was like, who cares? I don't know what I would have done if I had gotten pulled over. I was in my parents' car, you know, they were letting me drive it, but in my head, I was untouchable. And I keep drinking. Around the same time, I got a job at a restaurant, and the general manager was an alcoholic, and I became a manager, and I worked the 2 to 10 shift, and he basically told me, he said, hey, if you come in and drink a few beers, it's okay. You know, as long as people aren't smelling it on you, we don't care. And I was like, oh, that's awesome. You know, so I was able to drink at work. I thought it was awesome. I was also living or in the same apartment complex with a bunch of people I worked with. So we'd play drinking games before we would work, you know, and between 4 or 5 of us, we'd finish off a 30 pack and then I'd go to work. And I thought that was normal. And that was within 2 years of me really starting my drinking career. You know, looking back, I can't understand it. It's the insanity of this disease of me thinking all this stuff is okay. At the same time, you know, I pretty much give up on college. I'm not enjoying college. I'm now 21 or 22, drinking a lot. I'm now working at a different restaurant. I'm not drinking there, but I'm showing up hungover, and I'm pretty sure they're going to fire me after the holiday season. And one of my buddies says, let's move to Austin. And I'm like, well, that sounds like a good idea, you know. I had been kicked out of 2 or 3 bars in San Luis Obispo, so, you know, the bartenders were getting a little angry with me, so I was like, all right, this sounds like a good idea. I always used to say I moved to Austin, but looking back, the truth is I ran to Austin. I didn't tell my family I was moving. I just packed up my car and moved. You know, and then basically sent them a text message saying, hey, I don't want anything to do with you guys. I want to live in Austin. And yeah, because I did not know how to deal with this stuff. Alcohol was the only solution. And when stuff caught up to me, it was time to run. You know, that was my MO. And Austin was crazy. Austin, man, I looking back, it's a miracle I didn't kill myself or kill someone else. You know, very quickly, the restaurant I was working at, everyone there liked to drink. I mean, it was a bar restaurant, and it was constant every day, leaving drunk, driving home, you know, constant drinking on the job. Most of those people that I worked with are now either dead or in jail. Yeah, and I see this kind of stuff happening. The other thing too that was lovely at the restaurant I was working at, the kitchen manager was a cocaine dealer, so we had a lot of fun in the back. You know, it was go time all the time. It was, you know, if you started to get too drunk while you were going, they'd call you into the back and just have you go do a line in the fridge. That was how they woke you back up. It was just, I just thought this stuff was normal. I don't know why I thought it was normal, but to me it was just, that was life. And around the same time I get a new roommate, and he's like, hey man, I'm having trouble on rent. Are you okay if I start selling cocaine? And I say, well, okay, we need to pay rent, you know? So that was a whole other adventure. And I had some moment of clarity where I realized if I stay in Austin, I am gonna be dead in a few years or in jail. So I call up my parents and say, hey, can I move back home? And for whatever reason, they let me. This time, though, it was gonna be different. I was gonna stop drinking, I was gonna get my life together. And I cut my drinking way back for a while, for a few months, you know? I went back to school, still was working in the restaurant industry, but very quickly ramped my drinking back up, back into that insanity, you know, of drinking the normal amount with my family. I grew up around alcohol. Everyone in my family drinks, but no one drinks alcoholically. They drink for enjoyment. They can have 1, 2, 3 drinks, and they can put it down. That has never been me. But what I learned is that if I have those 3 or 4 drinks with them and then sneak out to the garage and have a beer or two and then sneak back to my room and have a shot or two, then they go to bed and then I can keep drinking. So, you know, I'm hiding my drinking, doing all this stuff, and my life is just getting worse and worse. It was around the same time that I moved back that I had to stop smoking marijuana because I would get so paranoid. And looking back, I'm thinking maybe that's when I really started to get spiritually sick, because when I smoked, I would just freak out. I'd have stuff going on in my head that I did not understand and didn't want to deal with. And so I stopped smoking marijuana. But alcohol, man, that was the solution. Kept drinking, you know. By this point, I couldn't hold down a job, wasn't paying my bills. My car gets repossessed. And so I say, okay, I'll try one AA meeting. And I went to a meeting and didn't get anything from it. Was like, oh, this isn't for me. I'll quit cold turkey and be fine. I also asked my dad if I could borrow some money so I didn't lose my car, and he helped me out. And looking back, I don't know if I was sober 30 days, 60 days, or 6 months, because I was just absolutely miserable. I was so angry, so unhappy. I was white knuckling it, that simple. And I don't remember where I picked up a drink or when I picked up a drink, but I started drinking in secret again. And a few months later, my parents were like, well, if you're gonna drink, you can drink around us. You know, they didn't really know what to do with me. You know, they had not been around. I have alcoholics outside of my immediate family, but no one close, none of my aunts or uncles. So they didn't really know what to do. So they just said, well, if you're gonna do it, you might as well do it where we can see what's happening. And at this point, this is 2022, 2023. Oh, another thing that happened in 2022 is I had to go in for emergency back surgery I ended up spending 5 days at Marion Hospital, but I didn't go through withdrawals. So I said, I can't be an alcoholic because I didn't go through withdrawals. And in my head, that made sense. I said, oh, you know, it doesn't matter. You know, if I would have gone through withdrawals. And that was another brief, I think I was sober 2 or 3 weeks after that because I told myself I was going to lose that weight and get healthy so that I wouldn't have a bad back. But very quickly drinking again. And at this point, my life was pretty much just pure misery. It was pretty much isolating all the time, just drinking in my room, blacking out every night, waking up. And I know something is wrong with my body, but I'm just ignoring it. Like, I ignore everything, you know, because alcohol lets me do that. Finally, I wake up one morning and I can tell something's not right. And throughout the day, I just feel absolutely terrible. I finally ask my dad to take me to the hospital. I go into the hospital and they diagnose me with diabetic ketoacidosis. Basically, my body's really beat up from drinking and eating unhealthy and not being physical at all. I end up spending 5 days in the hospital. That was pretty much pure hell. I can't imagine what that was like for my family, for my parents, you know, because they were there for most of it. You know, the first 3 days, I really didn't sleep in the hospital. My heart rate was averaging over 140. You know, they weren't sure if I was going to make it or not. But in that hospital, I had one of the first miracles that I look at of my sobriety. I had a nurse one night. In the critical care unit, each of the nurses have two patients they have to cover. And he didn't have a patient in his other bed. So he just kicked it with me, and we just watched movies. And I don't remember anything that was said. All I can remember is that he was a kind and loving person who listened to me. And I was like, man, it gave me some hope. It gave me some hope. I don't even remember the man's name. I wish I did, but he just talked to me and treated me like a human being. And I don't blame any of the nurses and doctors how they treated me. They did a great job taking care of me. But there really wasn't much they could do for me. They could give some stuff to me and I either got better or I didn't, you know. But that man being a kind ear meant so much to me. I end up getting out of the hospital on a Friday, and I ended up going to this technically my second AA meeting on that Sunday, and I had no idea what I was really walking into. You know, I had all I knew of AA was that it was a bunch of old guys who smoked cigarettes and drank coffee. That was my whole idea of what AA was. So I walk into these rooms, and I think everyone could tell I was pretty fresh, you know. And one of the gentlemen walks up to me, and he says, oh, hey, when it comes to you, you can say Ryan visiting, you can say Ryan alcoholic. And I remember thinking, oh, it's my choice, okay. I was like, at this point, I probably have to say I'm an alcoholic, right? I mean, I've been to the hospital, I've wrecked my life completely. I have no power over alcohol. I don't even really know about the first step. But I know that if I drink again, I didn't mention this, the doctor basically told me I'd be dead within 1 or 2 years if I picked up alcohol again. I was pretty sure my parents would kick me out. So I was like, I need to be sober, because if I drink again, I'm going to be homeless and dead. So I did not want that. Yeah, so I go into that AA meeting, and I don't remember anything that was said, but I do remember men coming up to me and saying, hey, there's a chance, you know? They said, if you really want this to work, you have a chance of staying sober. And I'm like, I don't really understand how that's going to work, but okay, you know, I'll give it a chance. I was so sick and tired. I was, one of the miracles that I was given is that I had the gift of desperation. I needed to change my life. I was so sick and tired. That first month, maybe even 2 months in AA, I was sleeping 14 to 16 hours a day, just absolutely exhausted all the time because my body was so beat up. Just so sick and tired. I had no energy to say no. Whatever I heard, I was going to give it a try because it had to be better than the life I had been living. You know, because the last 6 months of my drinking were my definition of hell. You know, it was just so miserable. And at that first meeting, I met my sponsor. He came up, he gave me his business card and said, oh, I'll help you with the book and all this other stuff. And so I quickly got into step work, quickly got into commitments. It's kind of funny. My first commitment was at a meditation meeting. And the first meditation meeting I attended, every week it's a different meditation. And this one talked about chakras and all this other stuff. And I was like, this is crazy. How is this helping me stay sober? But there was a commitment available and my sponsor said, hey, you should take this commitment. I couldn't say no at that point. I had no energy or willpower to say no. So I said, okay. And I believe it was that third week that for the first time in years, I had 10 minutes of silence. I had 10 minutes where my head shut up, where I felt okay. And that was amazing. And I've been doing that ever since. Meditation is a very big part of my recovery. It's amazing. And I would not have gotten that without a commitment, without listening to my sponsor. As this is also happening, I see men that are happy and I start to say, I want that. I want to live this life that these guys have. They seem like they're happy. So I start to listen and I start to feel something in these rooms. At the time, I didn't really know what it was, but now looking back, it was my higher power saying, hey, this is going to happen. I remember praying out and feeling something praying out. At the time, I had no idea what it was, but there was something there. And step one was really easy for me. You know, everything I just explained. My life was, I was powerless over alcohol and life had become unmanageable. Step two was really difficult. I forgot about this part. Another thing that happened I grew up in the church, and in sixth or seventh grade at the church I was at, we had an interim youth pastor who I grew really close to. He was amazing. He was a very spiritual person. And they end up getting a full-time youth pastor, and the head pastor of the church ended up deciding that to ease the transition, the interim youth pastor could no longer be part of the youth group. And that just broke my heart. You know, that was another thing that just made me so angry. And I said, how can a God do that? You know, so I was just so angry at God for so many things. But that was one of the big ones that just started me to want to have no relationship with a higher power. And when I first came into these rooms, if someone had asked me, I would have said, I don't believe in God, and if there is a God, I have a hatred for him. That was just, that's what I thought. So step two was really tough, and I'm working with my sponsor, but I'm feeling something in the rooms. I'm starting to feel some hope. I'm starting to feel that, hey, maybe I can make this work. And my sponsor said, that's all you need. You're opening the door. He said, you don't have to blow it wide open. You just have to have some idea that a higher power could help you. And so I was like, oh, okay, I can get on board with that. You know, I can move on from there. So I did. Step three was easy because I didn't want to be in charge of my life anymore. I was over being in charge of my life. I had run my life into the ground. So that was an easy step for me. And really that just involved me asking other people in AA, what do you think I should do about this? And I'd actually hear solutions. You know, for years it had been, worry about my problems, keep worrying, drink to stop worrying about them, and then not do anything about them. You know, I finally found in these rooms that I can actually deal with life's problems, that I can deal with life on life's terms if I'm willing to give this program a try. About 2 or 3 months into my sobriety, one of them asked me, oh, can you help out at the Central Coast Roundup? And I think I'm signing up for, you know, a 2 or 3 hour gig one day. And I say, sure, why not? And then, you know, a week before, he said, oh yeah, so I'll need you here on Friday at 3, Saturday at 10, and Sunday at 10, and then you'll be here most of the day. I'm like, oh, okay, I guess I said yes, why not, you know? And I'm so glad I did. I loved working that roundup. I loved being there. A big part, it's a super small thing, but on Saturday when all the men were out there barbecuing, one of the guys had brought some ribs that he was barbecuing for himself and to take home or whatever. And I walk out and I'm talking to him, and he just said, Ryan, you want a rib? And I just remember thinking, yeah, I want a rib. And I just remember thinking, this guy, man, people had not been kind to me outside of my immediate family. I had not seen just kindness. It was such a small thing. But him giving me that rib, I was like, man, that's cool. I don't know why. I just remember that being one of the turning points in my sobriety of saying, people in this program care about you. They help you. I had been among selfish people who would never really help you. So yeah, to him it was just a rib, but to me it did so much for my sobriety. So looking back, you know, I'm so happy I worked that roundup. You know, it was not at all what I expected, but I loved it. Keep going on, and then my first real rough patch in sobriety came when I turned 32. I had been 4 months sober. My parents went out of town. I had alienated so many friends, so many people that no one really wished me happy birthday. And then I go over to one of my friends' houses, and they're celebrating a birthday, but not mine. They're celebrating someone else. Everyone had forgotten about my birthday, and I was like, I was pissed. I was angry, you know. But I had been such a bad friend. No one had wanted to be around me for years because they weren't sure when it was going to happen. But within a few hours of being with me, I was going to be blackout drunk, you know. So I was just so angry. I was all absorbed in myself, just thinking about me. And, you know, that night, I honestly thought about picking up a drink, but I said, you know what, I'll get through this night and think about it tomorrow, because I had heard that from a lot of people. I said, well, think about it tomorrow. So that's what I did. Still angry all day, and I get a call from my doctor. And he said, Ryan, good job, you're healthy again. You've lost, by this point I had lost about 60 pounds. My blood sugar was way better, my liver was working again, my pancreas was working again, and it's what I needed in that moment, you know, because that was on a Monday, and I wasn't sure if I was going to go to that meditation meeting and meet with my sponsor that night, you know, but I got that phone call, and for me, that was God answering my prayers. That was me saying, okay, life is getting better. I'm getting healthier. I'm seeing improvement. And if I had picked up that drink the night before, I probably wouldn't have answered that phone. And who knows if I would have made it back in these rooms, you know? And that was just one of the miracles that happened. Another big part in my sobriety is in January of this year, I went into a meeting in a detox, and we all share, and then it comes to we ask people in the panel, on the panel, in the detox if they want to talk, and one of the men says, yeah, I know I'm here right now, but once I get out, you know, when I'm done with a long day of work, I think I deserve a beer. I want to drink a beer again. And it just reminded me how crazy this disease is, how insane we are when we're in the middle of our alcoholism. That, you know, someone in detox that is, from my understanding at least, completely ruined his life, and he still wants to go back out and drink. And it reminded me, man, I got a lot of work to still do. I have a lot of things that I still need to focus on. You know, and I applaud that man for his honesty, because he could have easily not said anything, but he was willing to be honest and said, hey, when I get out, I'm going to go back out and drink. So regardless of what I think, his honesty was amazing. And another big thing in my sobriety. Around the same time, I also got the men's stag on Thursday nights in Orchid. That's my home group, home meeting. And I became secretary of that meeting, you know, at 5.5 months sober. And I was like, this is really cool. I've really enjoyed doing that. You know, my sponsor is very big on getting commitments, because commitments, they've kept me coming back to meetings when I've thought, you know, maybe tonight I could skip a meeting. So I've loved doing that. And, you know, it's been going really good. In June, I went on a houseboat trip for 7 days. And I was worrying about it, because I like to go to a meeting every day. I like to go to at least 5 or 6 meetings a week. I sometimes don't make it every day, but 5 or 6 meetings a week. And I'm going to have to go 7 days without a meeting. So I'm kind of worrying about that. And I talked to my sponsor about it, and he says, well, why don't you talk to one of the men who goes on a houseboat trip every year? I was like, oh, that's a good idea. You know, don't wallow in my problems. Talk and bring it up. And he pointed me to him, and this gentleman said, well, you know, what I do is I just go for a walk when I have the need. And I said, oh, that's a great idea. Why didn't I think of that? Or he said he goes for a swim. And I said, huh, why didn't I ever think about that? It's so simple. But in my head, I was like, this, I don't know how I'm going to do this. And it was really easy. I took a big book. I took a 12 and 12. I read out of both of those every day. I went for a lot of walks. I definitely wasn't as nice as I should have been at certain points throughout my trip, but I stayed sober. I kept working my program, and I had started to spiral on that. And I forget how easy it is. If I go and talk to someone in this program, they either have the solution or they can point me to someone that has dealt with the same problem. But in my mind, it's the end of the world. There's no solution. There can't be a way out of this. Yet it's such a simple problem. You know, it in my head, it was such a big deal that I wasn't going to have a meeting for 7 days. And yet I didn't feel stressed. I felt stressed about other stuff, but not about drinking. Also this year, I have sponsored a few people. That's been different, you know, because I want to hit them over the head and say, go and do this, go and do that. But I have to remember how my sponsor has taught me, and that's, you show them the way that you live your life, you show them the steps, and you leave the rest up to God. You know, because I want to tell people, no, go to meetings, it'll work out great for you. All I can do is try my best and then leave it up to God. Because I want to take back control. I want to make the decisions. I want to tell people, do this and you'll stay sober. I don't know if they'll do that and stay sober. I don't have that crystal ball, but in my head I do. In my head I think that, oh, I'm in control here. But I'm not. I have to remember to leave it up to God. You know, it's, I find myself taking back my self-will not more often, but it takes me a little longer to catch it. You know, in those first 6 or 8 months, it was very easy for me to realize most of the time that, oh, I'm just thinking about myself. And now I've realized sometimes I'll get a few days that goes by and I'm like, well, what have I done for someone other than gone to meetings? Have I done anything nice or kind and not taken credit for it? You know, because that was a big one that I heard from a lot of people in these rooms, that do something nice every day and don't take credit for it. You know, that was a new thing for me. I was like, man, if I do something nice, I want credit for it. I want everyone to pat me on the back and say, good job, Ryan. You know, because, you know, even when I was out there drinking, I would still help people on occasion, but I always wanted something for it. It was more for me than for them. But I realized through service to others, I am so much happier than I have probably ever been. My life is way different than I ever expected it to be. You know, this week I'd been getting a little nervous about speaking, and this is my 8th or 9th meeting this week, because now when I get nervous, I go to meetings, I talk about it, I figure out solutions, I deal with life on life's terms. And it's not always easy. You know, I still have a lot of things I need to work on. I still have some amends I need to make. You know, but to me, I wouldn't not trade this life for anything right now. You know, I love being sober. It is amazing. I wake up with a smile on my face. For so many years, I woke up not even remembering how I got into where I fell asleep. You know, just saying, oh, huh, here's where I am. Okay, let's get going. You know, I get to remember my day. I get to live life on life's terms. I get to be happy. I also get to be sad. But I'm able to deal with that stuff with the help of people in these rooms. Anything else? I think that's it. Thanks, guys.
Awesome, Ryan. Let's give Ryan another round of applause.